This is an ABC podcast.
Maloni, bon dia and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show, we'll be bringing you the latest in the lead-up to Samoa's snap election, as well as the dengue cases that are on the rise, and calls for funding to address skyrocketing numbers of HIV/AIDS crises in PNG. All that and more coming your way. I'm Aggie Thubow, and I say obrigada. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, with just under 2 weeks to go, Samoans are preparing for its election day on August 29. Initially expected to be held next year, Prime Minister Fiamea Naomi Mataafa announced a snap election after its parliament voted down the government's budget in May. This is after the Prime Minister survived two votes of no confidence earlier in the year. Now, with all its political drama, how is the country feeling in the lead-up to the early election? Well, joining us live is our ABC reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin. Did I say malolo soifua, Adele?
Malolo soifua, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Adele, as I mentioned in the intro, you know, there's only literally under 2 weeks away. What has or what is the mood or the atmosphere like leading up to Election Day?
Yes, thank you. Aggie, I'm getting mixed reactions from members of the public about how they're feeling right now. But here's what some of them had to say.
I feel excited because we have so many people contesting, and I'm just curious who will be our leaders, since we have some strong leaders campaigning.
I'm eager for the election to end, as it's causing division and disagreements among our people due to differing political party loyalties.
Well, thanks for that, Adele. I mean, you know, while you're there on the ground, are you aware of how many have actually registered to vote? Like, and I ask this because is the turnout generally high when people are voting in Samoa?
Yes. As of this month, the Electoral Commissioner, John Stanley, has confirmed that approximately 101,981 voters are eligible to vote in the upcoming election. Now, this final count reflects the removal of deceased and overseas individuals, and also the inclusion of 16 Falealupo voters. This is after a challenge to their eligibility was withdrawn from court. Now, voter turnout is high, you know. Generally, it is high during, you know, voting for Samoa. But, you know, now, I mean, for this particular election, you know, we've seen so much voter engagement, you know, and it is evident through these political campaigns that parties are hosting, yes.
Yeah, yes, that leads me to ask you, how have those campaigns been going, especially for the three main parties? You know, we have the HRPP, we've got FAST, and of course, Fiamea's new, you know, party, the Samoa Uniting Party. Yeah, how has it been going?
Campaigns have been energetic, I would say, but with promises aimed at health, education, welfare, and, you know, economic transformation. You know, these have been promises by the main political parties. Now, it is evident through the respective party rallies that, you know, these promises are being welcomed by their supporters. Now, support for each political party has been strong. You know, now for this particular year, it you know, campaigns have gone, you know, I would say it's on a different level now. We're looking at vibrant colours, you know, and for each political party, they have their own colours. If you didn't know, FAST represents red in Samoa, HRPP is blue, and then we've got the Samoa Uniting Party, which is the Prime Minister's party. It's green, yellow, and white, basically. So you will see many people wearing T-shirts that are red around the country. You've got flags that are red that they represent the political parties, you know. And another funny thing about these political parties is that each of them have their own theme song,
nice.
You know, and then across the whole whole of Samoa, these songs are being played on the radios, they're being played on social media and at these gatherings. So they really stepped up their game in terms of, you know, campaigning. And let's not forget, everywhere you go, whichever village you visit, you will see billboards of each political candidate. Mm. It's either you're looking at an independent candidate, you're looking at a FAST, HRPP, you name it, they're all there, basically. So that's campaigning for us.
Nice. Well, look, Adele, with the community, what have they sort of said to you in terms of change? Like, do you know what the main issue is that's sort of playing a role in who they're wanting to vote for?
Yes, public feedback, you know, shows a strong desire for a new government then that can address the high cost of living. It's been the most common issue being shared and expressed, you know, as a concern for members of the public. But here's what they had to say as well, some of them on what they think is an issue that matters to them.
The main issue is high cost of living, and I hope the new government will assist our people with this daily struggle.
Access to education is a key issue for me, so I'm voting for leaders who will secure my children's future by providing free education.
Yeah, definitely some common issues there. Was there any more that you needed to add to that, Adele?
Another issue that we're seeing our people now struggle with is health. You know, the health facilities, and, you know, because we are going through an outbreak with dengue fever, they really need, you know, it's a government that will provide more doctors, nurses, will provide more health facilities. This is one of the main issues that our people are facing at the moment, and they're showing a lot of concern around this issue, especially now that lives have been lost to dengue fever.
Yeah, well, Adele, as you say, dengue fever is still raging in Samoa. And then we know that in the lead up to this outbreak, Prime Minister Fiume called for an actual national cleanup day. Like, how did that actually go? And again, later stats on that?
Yeah, so far over 8,000 people have been confirmed to have been infected with dengue fever since January this year. However, with the national cleanup, it's been a nationwide effort, I would say. Thousands of people took part in this nationwide cleanup. You know, and you think on Saturday morning, you would drive around the villages and you will see everybody just either picking up rubbish, cutting down, you know, unnecessary, you know, trees that are blocking the area that would just make way for a cleaner environment. And so everybody's just like either, you know, with a wheelbarrow or, you know, with one of the brooms, you know, we would say it, the sarutu over here, you know, everybody weeding the grass, you know, all of them contributed to this nationwide cleanup. And it was successful, you know, just a lot of them sharing that, you know, this is a nation, it needs a nationwide, you know, effort to help and assist with trying to, you know, tackle or combat dengue fever, basically. But so far, 6 deaths have been confirmed for dengue fever in Samoa.
And I must say, how is this, you know, how are we seeing this affect, you know, campaigning? Because you'd have quite a few people out and about, right, having to go and vote. So how are people feeling?
Oh, it hasn't affected campaigning for the political parties, I would say. The only main impact is the closure of schools for over 3 weeks now for the children. The government is prioritizing, you know, the closure of schools to ensure that the children are not infected, because, you know, it's the urban area where we're at. It's the Apia Town area that had the high cases, especially for where our villages are from as well, in the Waimaunga area. These are some of the main, you know, villages that are affected by dengue fever. As for campaigning for, you know, all the you know, the political parties, you know, the supporters show up. They are showing loyalty by supporting and showing up. You're looking at hundreds of people at some of these rallies. You know, it's not affecting our, you know, elections, basically, right now for our people. Like, they still show up. They still come and support, basically. Mm-hmm. But as for the children, they are the only ones that are impacted, you know, with the dengue fever outbreak right now.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Adele, look, it is great that you've been able to sort of share with us. This is sort of the beginning of our coverage in regards to, you know, the lead up to Samoa's election. So we will be keeping in touch with you. But I must say, whaafetai tili lava for your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Aggie. You have a lovely day.
You too. That is our ABC report in Samoa, Adele Fruin.
Newsroom 40. Hosted by me, Sam Wykes.
And me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nijan Footy Stars.
Nijan Footy. Nijan Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Well, as you would have heard, we just heard from our ABC report in Samoa about the dengue outbreak. And here is a little bit more where schools will be shut for another week as the country continues to battle that deadly dengue fever outbreak. Now, for some students, this will be the fourth week of schools being shut and classes disrupted. Since the start of January, there have been more than 7,000 dengue cases. Correct me if I'm wrong, 8,000 dengue cases with 6 confirmed deaths and cases continuing to rise. Samoa's Ministry of Health CEO, Aiyawa Chris Hazelman, says with the election around the corner, schools will now be closed for the entire month of August.
The following week, as we know, is the election day, and government has already passed that the 28th and the 29th of the month will, you know, be public holidays because of the elections. So it is good that we now get it, you know, very clear in our minds, you know, that we will end up not having any school for the whole month of August. And in doing so, we now have to plan ahead. And we now have to look at, you know, making amendments and changes to our school calendar. I want to make this very clear to all schools and to all parents. We are going to change the school calendar, even to the point that there may be no school holidays between term 3 and term 4 to make up for the time. And in doing so, we will also be looking at amending our not only the examinations. We are currently waiting on a cabinet directive, a decision from cabinet, which will influence our national assessments. On the other hand, there will also be changes towards our the actual dates of our national assessments. So we need to make those very clear. But so, as I mentioned, these are things that have to be looked at very carefully and thoroughly, because there will be financial implications. We need to look at our budget. There will be human resource implications in regards to our workers, and especially the fact that if we change the dates of our examinations, it will then mean changes to the whole marking process, the quality assurance process, and ensuring that our results come out during the normal time come the next 2026. We want to make sure that we fulfill this obligation, because there's the connection of the students leaving secondary to begin their tertiary level education up at the NUS or at the USP. So there is a lot of work, a lot of planning that will need to be done now that we are in these critical stages.
And that's Samoa's Ministry of Health CEO, Aiyawa Chris Hazelman, speaking there. And the dengue outbreak clearly having a huge impact on the education system there. Now, the leader of the Catholic Church in Papua New Guinea has called on the national government to immediately increase funding to address the skyrocketing number of new HIV/AIDS infections in the country. Cardinal Sir John Ribbitt's statement followed the government's declaration in June that PNG had a national HIV/AIDS crisis. Last year, the World Health Organization reported that around 11,000 new HIV/AIDS cases were found in PNG. The national government recently said it is doing all it can to deal with the issue. However, Cardinal Sir John Ribbitt told Caroline Tierman this is an urgent issue and must be dealt with immediately.
When HIV/AIDS virus came for the first time, the work by the government and by the council that was created for that purpose, National HIV/AIDS Council, and it was going very well and the awareness was going everywhere. But of course, while they were doing that, the warning also was saying that HIV/AIDS is here to stay. It will not go away completely. So when HIV/AIDS kind of slows down and went away, the government did not maintain support for the testing places and also the place for awareness and so on. So the funding really got reduced and put back into the health department. So now HIV and AIDS work is with the health department. It's not on its own be able to do things as in the time when it came first. So at this time, we were having our meeting of our clinics. We had two clinics here. And then in both clinics, they were showing that the increase of HIV infections was going very high. And I was seeing this report and I was asking our board members and those who were from our health clinics, how is it that this one is really increasing and it's really alarming? Then they said, yes, because the funding to support HIV testing and counseling is no longer there. And at this time, I told our board members to create a board for ecumenical churches, the PNG Christian Leaders Alliance, Leaders Alliance of all churches. So I told them that while the government is not putting funds to be able to make this moving and going, we will take this responsibility now. I mentioned it to them, that we will be the voice to be able to make people aware of this infection affecting our people. And the number has increased. That's why I was calling on the government to put more funding into trying to do awareness and sort treatment for HIV and AIDS. But now with the increase of infection of HIV and AIDS, I call on the government to put in more funds into the work of HIV and AIDS and to be able to ensure that the awareness must continue in our villages, in our places.
What is the Catholic Church doing in awareness or work being done to inform members about this issue of HIV/AIDS?
We try to make this awareness when they come to our clinics. We try to make known this awareness in our clinics, like when people come for treatment or that when they hear about this awareness being made. So I think it's in a way been trying to get our people in our own clinics, trying to make awareness to our patients, to our people.
Earlier you mentioned that all the mainline churches in Papua New Guinea are also concerned about this. Could you just explain a little bit of what was said during your meeting with the other mainline churches about this very issue?
Okay, we did have a meeting, and also we tried to encourage them to be able to start making awareness in their own churches also, so that the same message goes out to all, and that they are all aware of what is happening. And that has been the kind of awareness we try to make people aware of and make them realize that at this time HIV and AIDS is coming back again. And it's coming back could be worse because now the infection is 30 new infections a day. From 8, it was going up, and now I think they realize that it's 30 new infections a day. So the thing is that to make people aware of it, and the awareness must take place in the churches during the worship time. And also in the clinics where they have, all this should be done there because we don't get the funding to be able to support us in this, but they have to be able to kind of involve ourselves because we have the network. And through this network, I think the awareness like this can be given.
And that is head of the Catholic Church in PNG, Cardinal Sir John Ribbett, speaking there with Caroline Terman. Pacific Beat. Now, high-level talks in Geneva have failed to reach a consensus over a legally binding treaty to tackle plastic pollution. More than 1,000 delegates had gathered to try and agree on a deal, and the most divisive issues included caps on production, managing chemicals, and funding to help developing countries comply with the treaty. Some countries wanted to restart negotiations, but others have described the process as broken. Well, joining us this morning is Director of Waste Management and Pollution Control Program at SPREP, Anthony Tsalaoli. With that, I say good morning, Anthony, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Angie, and good morning to you and to your listeners.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for joining us. Look, Anthony, when we look at the fact that there was final negotiations that were happening, it actually ran into overtime. Why was that?
Yeah, Angie, you know, I guess to develop an international legally binding instrument is a very complex arrangement. You know, with almost 200 sovereign nations participating and needing to consider their national circumstances and capabilities, there is a level of complexity and maybe politics that has to be developed and worked through. So even though we have now had 6 meetings of the committee, so 6 INCs, and although we're getting closer to final text, the nuance of the different words and their meanings and the implications to perhaps national policies and the real cost of implementing and the real cost of the implementation are now becoming real. So the closer we get to the final text, the more these considerations will come into play. So I guess what we saw in Geneva was several countries protecting their national interests, I guess, over the need for global action on this existential crisis.
Well, Anthony, I understand, you know, the initial goal was to, you know, try to seek to cut plastics pollution by 75% over the next 15 years. Again, what was the outcome of that?
Well, I guess for the Pacific Islands, small island development states, the goal remains. And our goal has always been an ambitious treaty that includes controls of upstream measures to sustainable production and consumption, as well as efforts to improve product design, reduce plastic toxicity, increase the ability for reuse and recycling, and to provide the necessary funding for technology transfer, capacity building. These are core elements to the global instrument that will enable our people, the Pacific countries, to participate and for the global community to work towards achieving such a goal. So I think this is what was the, I guess, what we see as the outcomes for this treaty. Yeah?
And before we get to, you know, parts of that text, I wanted to know that, well, I understand that Palau had also really voiced their opinion. What was their response to the no treaty?
Well, I guess, you know, what we want is a strong treaty. We don't want a waste management treaty. What we want is a treaty that will address the needs, because such islands as in Palau, to the east of the Pacific, in Rapa Nui, French Polynesia, even the Cook Islands, many of the plastics that are ending up on those beaches are not from our islands. They come from outside the Pacific region. So a waste management treaty just wouldn't do us any good. We already are doing what we can. What we need is for the global community to address this existential issue that is affecting small island countries like the Pacific countries.
Well, I know, Anthony, that there were parts of, or like key articles on that full cycle of plastic pollution were actually removed from the text. Why was that?
Well, I guess this is still in negotiation. You know, I wouldn't say that they were removed. I guess they were. There is the formality of reviewing the text. So although, you know, what we got from the chair was a second text, it should be unsurprising that countries that extract petroleum products and then use this product, then use these to produce plastics, would try to protect their ability to do so. So it is a significant source of wealth creation for those countries. I guess that is why in the Pacific and over, as well as over 100 other ambitious countries are requesting, and it is for these producing countries to look to ensure sustainable production through global targets. You know, let's not produce more than what is needed. Let's work to phase out problematic plastics, single-use plastics, and plastics that are made from chemicals of concern that harm human health and pollute our environment. Huh? So I think this is the reason why it's very difficult. And I wouldn't say those were removed. I think we're still in the negotiation phase, so this is quite normal.
Yeah. Well, then, I know that there were calls for a complete rewrite of the treaty. Wondering who actually called for the rewrite on the treaty, because, I mean, who was holding things up and couldn't agree?
Well, you know, there were numerous voices calling for additional drafting efforts. You know, those in favor of an ambitious treaty and those seeking to secure a treaty that focused more on their national efforts rather than global standards. So there is much work still yet to be done globally to find a compromise that will assist in bringing all countries to the table to manage this global pollution crisis. So we've got a long way to go. And what we can see is many countries, many factions are still holding strong to what they think will be the best to their interests.
Can you confirm whether or not Australia was one of those that called on that? I mean, I know they were, you know, they're considered one of the major plastic producers. Because if they did call for this, what does this mean then for COP31?
Well, I wouldn't be able to answer that. I think you'd have to ask Australia about that. But, however, what we can say is that Australia was very ambitious in these negotiations. Australia was advocating for an ambitious treaty during the negotiations, and you know, Australia even co-sponsored a conference room paper, which is one of the, I guess, one of the proposals. It's called a conference room paper on Indigenous knowledge, and also assisted championing the position of Pacific Island developing nations. So Australia has been a big friend of the Pacific and big friend of an ambitious target. So, but in terms of COP31, you'd have to ask that.
Thank you for that, Anthony. Look, I know also that the OECD, you know, warns that without intervention, plastic production will triple by 2016. What will this mean then for the Pacific?
Well, I guess plastic pollution is an existential crisis facing the world, but it is an issue that is reality for Pacific Island communities daily. Eh? I guess as custodians of the world's largest ocean and dependent upon the ocean for our livelihoods, plastic pollution poses a very real and immediate threat. Studies in the past few years have found overwhelmingly that microplastics are found in fish we harvest and therefore are consumed by our people. The Pacific people consume more fish than the global average citizen. And we know that chemicals are leaching into our bodies, and science is yet to know the true impact of this. However, I think what we are advocating for is the precautionary principle, which dictates that if you don't know the real impact of something, we should act with caution and manage the issue until we know what is harmful and what isn't. This is the basis of the position of ambitious countries. We know pollution is bad. Globally, almost every country have laws managing pollution. Mm. This is just an issue that has global implications. I think that together with the precautionary principle, as enshrined in the, you know, such as the Rio Declaration, it requires us to act and manage this issue until we know more. So I guess the precautionary principle is what we are advocating for.
Yeah. And Anthony, you know, knowing that there is sort of no decision that's been made yet in regards to the plastics treaty, where to from here then?
That's a good question. Angie, I think that, you know, we will have to wait until the INC Secretariat's notification for a resumed INC 5.3. The Pacific will again attend and will push for an ambitious treaty that will serve and protect the world's largest oceans and the communities that daily strive to protect it. Eh? So we will be there. We're very happy and we're very thankful for the funding support from the government of Australia to enable the Pacific to attend and to actively participate. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time this morning, Anthony. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And that is Director of Waste Management and Pollution Control Program at SPREP, Anthony Talauli. Right now, we'll be going into your news wrap. Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region. It's been a while, but we've got our producer Carl Evans in the studio with me this morning to bring us the latest headlines. How are you doing, sir?
It has been a while, hasn't it, since we've done News Wrap? No, I'm well. We had a
good weekend.
A really nice family gathering at our new apartment over the weekend. We ordered food for 10 people and they gave us food for 20.
Leftovers.
Trying to get rid of it has been the hard part since then.
Nice. Well, good to have you you in the studio this morning. Of course, we've got a couple of headlines. First one here, we head to global politics. Looks like Tuvalu is considering pulling out of Pacific Leaders Summit next month in Honiara.
Yes, that is correct. So the country's PM, Feleti Teo, said a boycott is on the cards after host nation Solomon Islands moved to block all external partners, including China, US and Taiwan, from attending last week. It's a move that's shaken regional unity over the last few days, as we've seen with Samoa's PM echoing similar sentiments, as well as the Fijian leader, Sitiveni Rambuka. And that's because many are speculating that the move was aimed at keeping Taiwan out of the meeting at the behest of China, who is obviously having an increasingly larger say on Pacific diplomacy. And, you know, as we know, Tuvalu, they're only one of three remaining countries that maintain diplomatic ties with Taiwan. So as of now, they are still going, but Teo said he would wait to see how other Pacific leaders respond before deciding whether or not to pull the pin on the forum next month.
Well, there's some big calls. But meanwhile, Taiwan has responded to the move to block partners from attending. What did they say?
Yeah, they've said it's regrettable, with their Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Minister for Foreign Affairs, expressing disappointment yesterday. You know, despite being one of 20-odd donor countries locked out, the decision does feel somewhat targeted to them, he said. And he reminded PIF of a 1992 agreement that gives all PIF partners, including Taiwan, the right to attend, which they've done so for the last three decades until now.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a wait and see. We'll see how that develops. We head to the world of sport because I believe special mouth guards that flash red during head collisions will be used at the Women's World Cup, which kicks off this week. How does that all work?
I know, this is an interesting one, isn't it? So, yeah, it's new technology, which was first trialled in the US in the Major League Rugby. I keep wanting to say Major League Baseball, Major League Rugby. Anyway, but it's called a smart mouth guard. It's going to have LED lights, which will flash red if the impact is severe enough to potentially cause a concussion. So the referee will then be able to stop play, and then the player will be allowed to send off for a head injury assessment. And It's basically designed to inform match officials instantly, so players can get, you know, faster treatment, as well as inform, you know, fans at home as to what's happened and why one of their favourite players might have been potentially just taken off the field.
Okay, well, that's for the women, but will the men have to wear it too?
Yeah, that's the big question. Eventually, they will have to. So they'll be introduced into the men's game for the Rugby Championship next year. I'm not sure if this is just going to be an international rule or if it's going to filter down to a club level as well. And as for the Women's World Cup, which will actually kick off this weekend, all but two women will wear them when the World Cup kicks off. The two that won't have to wear them will have exemptions due to their braces in their mouth. They'll lack that protection, unfortunately. But it's going to be really interesting to see what that looks
new
like
when
it happens.
Yeah. Well, okay, speaking of sport, the Marshall Islands, are they no longer the only team in the world without an international soccer team?
No, not as of the weekend. So they literally spent the weekend creating history, playing their first ever international match against the Virgin Islands in Springfield, Arkansas, which is the very heart of Marshallese diaspora in the US, as it turns out. They went down 4-0 in their first game, but the team, which, you know, they put up an incredible performance, especially considering they only came together less than a week before kickoff. Mm-hmm. In their second match, however, against Turks and Caicos Islands, it was a slightly different story. They did still lose, but this time it was a narrower one, only losing 3-2 with the final score there.
Nice.
But their fans did get to experience their country's first ever goal. So let's check out the reaction of commentator Ben Curtis when the Marshallese found the back of the net.
Nice.
Pat Phelan able to open up a little bit of space. Blanton laying it off along the left. Back it goes. Josiah Blanton could be in. A moment of Marshallese magic. At long last, a goal for the Marshall Islands. A goal for all the Marshall Islands.
Great ball in, a great run from Josiah Bland, and he tucks it home, and he etches himself into soccer history for the Marshall Islands.
Here's the outswinging corner kick towards the back post. Penalty! It's a penalty for the Marshall Islands. Anatok broken to make it two for the Marshall Islands, and he does! Slots it home coolly, and it is game on in Springdale. And that is the full-time whistle. A victory for Turks and Caicos, but what a performance put in by the Marshall Islands in just their second ever match as a soccer federation. Two goals, and they had real chances to get a result out of this match. They have so very, very much to be proud of.
A moment of Marshallese madness. Wow. I wonder if he had that one
their
queued up.
Their commentator, Ben Curtis, is something else. What a hype person you would need on your team.
I'll need to listen to that again to memorise the name of the guy who kicked that first goal, because that'll be a trivia question down the track.
There we go.
Who scored the Marshall Islands' first ever soccer goal? A moment of Marshallese magic.
I love that. Well, hey, look, and well done to the Marshallese to even get that far. So, Kyle, as always, thank you so much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. Well, a traditional double-hulled canoe has been officially launched in Vava'utonga. It's the result of a collaboration between Tongan and Fijian traditional builders on behalf of the University of the South Pacific's Pacific European Union Marine Partnership Program and the Uto Niyelo Trust. The aim of the project is to revive traditional Pacific voyaging skills. Have a listen.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the successful completion of this canoe building and sail training phase actually marks a significant milestone revitalizing Tonga's proud maritime heritage. It's a project that shows that, you know, through collaborative efforts between technical experts, community stakeholders, and international partners or donors, you know, we demonstrated how traditional knowledge and modern innovation can actually intersect to create a sustainable, culturally meaningful solution to some of the issues that we are facing today. So it's not just a means of transport. It's a symbol of resilience and adaptation. You know, it embodies probably an approach to sustainable development that honors the past while, you know, navigating modern challenges like climate change and environmental degradation. So it's more than just trying to revive traditional knowledge. We see these canoes as being the solution to some of our bigger challenges that we are facing.
Could you expand on the collaboration and why Tonga and Fiji?
The work is actually aligned with the University of the South Pacific Fume Project's intention to work on sustainable sea transportation in Tonga. And so they were very interested. The Uto Niyelo Trust has an existing memorandum of understanding with the University of the South Pacific, which promotes collaboration in education, research, and cultural preservation. And so it was based on that MOU with the USP that was decided that we would extend our work in traditional navigation into Tonga. So we did a scoping exercise in August of last year in Tonga. The Uto Niyelo Trust has an existing smaller canoe, which we call the Wangavode, which has gone over different phases of adaptation. And so it was this Wangavode that we had taken on this scoping exercise to Tonga and introduced it to them. And then, you know, the Tongans that we spoke to found that the design would be very useful for them, but it needed some adaptation because some of the materials that we were using in the build in Fiji were not available in Tonga. And so it was decided that we would create a hybrid design, especially for Tonga.
It's interesting you talked about how in Tonga they didn't have the materials available because we've seen that in history where a lot of the big Tongan canoes were actually built in Fiji with the materials there, and we still see that happening now.
The Kalia, the Alia out of Samoa and Fiji's Nrua are of very similar design. There are some uniqueness to it, but they are practically sailed in the same way. These are shunting canoes. The Tongans and not only Tongans, but the Samoans are also known to have moved to Fiji, the builders, because of the availability of the material, that is the timber, or the tree that was used to construct the hull. And so, yeah, so these are ancient ties that we are talking about, you know, which still exist today. And we were happy to, you know, to sort of revive some of that through this project.
And this particular canoe, the Wanga Vode, could you describe its design?
So the Wanga Vode is a modern, it uses modern materials. Eh? The hulls are fiberglass, okay, and it speaks of the use of modern science. But the molds and or the hulls are actually, the design of the hulls are actually honoring the old shape. Eh? So it's a low carbon sea transport model. It's an innovative low carbon sea transport model without discarding ancestral insight. What we are facing here is in Fiji, not only in Tonga, but in Fiji, we currently, there's no motivation to build the real traditional canoes that are made out of timber or log hull simply because of existing maritime safety policies, which would require, you know, if you want to go and get a fishing license, a license to fish in your fishing ground, you will need to show that you have a vessel which is maritime safety certified. If you want to use it in the tourism space, you need to show a vessel which is maritime safety certified. And so the challenge for us here is, you know, there's no motivation anymore, you know, amongst the traditional canoe builders to build these things. And so the Otoniello Trust, we're still embarking on this journey, is to try to find the middle ground between the traditional canoe designs and what is needed to meet maritime safety requirements. And so this canoe, that the design that we've come up with, it's based on the Wanga Vode model that we have, but we engaged a naval architect to actually draw the designs. So we understand that there's been discussions that we've been in where people question meeting maritime safety standards and ensuring that people who have lost the art of sailing, our traditional canoes, our traditional shunting canoes, gather that knowledge. So for us, we will build this. We'll teach you how to build the hulls. We'll teach you how to lash it together. We'll teach you how to rig up the masts and the sails. We'll teach you how to sail it. And the intention is, once you master that art of, you know, lashing, rigging, and sailing, and if you want to go and, you know, do a dugout from a tree, by all means, go and do it, you know, but at least the knowledge of sailing is still there.
And that was Titi Fong, president of Otoniello Trust.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Right, while the future of Tonga's national rugby sevens team is still hanging in the balance, with Lakapi Samoa have no plans to wind up their sevens program. But just like the TRU, the Samoan Union is still in the dark about precisely how the latest version of the World Rugby Sevens series will play out. In the end, Chief Executive Douglas Nau Chun is of the opinion that the new setup will provide a decent pathway for Samoa's men to follow back to the elite group after their relegation in 2024. But as you'll hear, it's very clear that the CEO thinks his union deserves to be treated with more respect by the officials at the World Rugby HQ.
We're struggling, but we're not giving up on our seven cities, because to us, our sevens is a money-earning program for us. So that's why we're still investing. Currently, our two coaches for Manusina and our main sevens are working together with the clubs, because we have a circuit that is happening now on island. We just had the first tournament, so we're hoping to announce our squads around September, October. Our first outing will be the Oceania Sevens in November, and we still haven't heard from World Rugby on the dates of the Challenger. All we know is the final two teams to fill up the Tier 2 are yet to be confirmed, because we have to play through the Challenger. And from there, I think the Tier 2 competition is scheduled to start in February. So we have a fair understanding that we might have the Challenger around December, January.
I suspect you feel very frustrated, but do you feel a little insulted that you're being treated this way by World Rugby? They changed the rules a couple of days out from the finals at the end of last season, and here we are several months later, and you're telling me exactly the same thing that your opposite number in Tonga told me, that World Rugby have told you nothing.
To be honest, Richard, you know, it really has an impact on us, because the understanding we had when we went to LA, all we need to do is win that tournament and go back to become a tier one. And all of a sudden, just a couple of days away from kickoff, and they make the announcement. And I think that was very poor from a rugby's position. They were very inconsiderate of that announcement. And it has a negative impact on our boys, because it really affects them mentally. Because what's the point of going through the qualifiers? We're not going to be in tier one. We're going to end up being a tier two. So what was the reason why we have to come back with the other four teams to the challenger? They can't even have the tier two because they have to wait for the two from the challenger. So they should have played another match in order to get direct qualification for the two teams to make up the tier two that we're going to have for next year.
So whichever way you look at it, as and when you get clarification and dates from World Rugby, it's a much, much harder road now for Manu Samoa to make it back into the core group. And clearly, Manu Sina have to go down the same road to try and break into the women's core group for the first time in their case.
You know, for a country like us, that we're struggling financially, World Rugby is giving us more headache and more frustrations just to make sure we get there. But our people are resilient, and you know, we're up for any challenge that comes ahead. And then we trusted our management that they will do a good job this time and make sure that we get through the qualifications and get through to become a tier one, hopefully by the end of 2026.
How important is the Sevens team to the nation? Bearing in mind, of course, not so very long ago, Samoa were the world champions and the country was given the day off.
You know, our people, they always have a soft spot for the Sevens program because the majority of the team is locally based, and it's the only opportunity for our locals to be exposed to international events. And the Sevens, they played nearly 6 months of rugby, and our people get to see them on the TV often. And our people believe we have more chance of winning a World Cup in Sevens compared to the 15s.
So you're determined to carry on. You're determined to climb over however many hurdles World Rugby put in the way. And is there anything that you can do as a union to assist Tonga, and when they're talking about maybe giving Sevens away? I'm not suggesting financially, but in terms of moral support and putting pressure on World Rugby perhaps to help.
Well, the only thing that we really need to look at is the rugby within Oceania. You know, we're currently in negotiations with the Australian rugby, and we're putting together the high performance program funding that I believe if that goes ahead, that will definitely benefit Samoa and Tonga in the long run in terms of the Sevens program. We look at it in a positive way, Richard. We're not undermining the teams in the Challenger Series, but we saw what happened last year. You know, we're confident as a union that, you know, if we put all our cards right, we can get through being the top two teams on the Challenger. And this new format to us, we have a higher chance of making the tier one compared to the original one. Because if we're able to secure our place in the tier two competition for 2026, and if we're able to secure a top four finish after the three rounds, we will be playing the top eight in the championship rounds, which is three rounds as well for next year. And if we can secure a top eight finish in the championship rounds, we are secured to be tier one for 2027.
And that is Douglas Nelchin, Chief Executive of Lakapi Samoa, in a confident mood about the future of the Union Men's Rugby Sevens team. And he was talking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Apia.
Time is running out to enter the Pacific Break competition for 2025.
So if you've got original music and big dreams, this is your moment. But entries close Monday, August 25th.
You could win an all-expenses-paid trip to perform at Warm Adelaide, Australia's biggest international music festival.
Woo. Don't miss your chance. Head to abc.net.au/Pacific Break and get your tracks in before it's too late.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Let's recap our top story, where high-level talks in Geneva have failed to reach a consensus over a legally binding treaty to tackle plastic pollution.
Although we're getting closer to final text, the nuance of the different words and their meanings and the implications to perhaps national policies and the real cost of the implementation are now becoming real.
And that is Director of Waste Management and Pollution Control Program at SPREP, Anthony Talaoli. Now remember, you can find all our top stories on our website. You just simply have to type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. You can listen to Pacific Beat live, or you can catch up on full Pacific Beat programs and individual stories. Now remember, you can find us on our socials. We are on Facebook or Instagram. You just simply need to look for ABC Pacific. Now, we will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can also hear us again this afternoon, 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nija Daily. So until next time, Otoa o whaato. You've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.